Nancy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from Tantalk Radio Network Studio in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Well, it's fun to say that my next guest, my first guest today, is someone who has stepped up to the plate and knocked one out of the ballpark. David O. Stewart has written a fantastic book called The Babe Ruth Deception. Hi, David.
Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. There, we have a little music for you.
Oh, I love it.
Okay, well, David, it's so nice to have you on because I just love this book. And, of course, just coming off of the 112th World Series, which was an exciting event.
It was,
to put it mildly. Boy, that was a good one. Well, it's so much fun, and that's why I wanted to have you on to, you know, everyone's interested in baseball right now, and so I decided to squeeze you in here. I can't have a very long interview, but I have invited you to come back in January to do an hour show because I want to talk about your other books in this series. The Babe Ruth Deception is the third one, and, of course, the other two before that were the Lincoln Deception and the Wilson Deception.
Correct.
So we're going to have you back on, and we're going to talk pick your brain about presidents in general, because, of course, you are such a great historical writer. But this is the baseball time, and so we're going to talk today about just the Babe Ruth one. It's fantastic.
Well, don't let me cut you off.
Well, you know, I love baseball. That's my sport. I never get tired of baseball. And you have captured so beautifully the time, and of course the Babe, and it's just such a great read.
Well, I appreciate it. It is a special time in the game because it's a weird mixture. There's an innocence to the game. And frankly, a rank corruption to it, because you're in the middle of trying to clean up after the World Series fixing the 1919 series, the Black Sox scandal. So I just found that a fascinating contrast to try to capture.
Well, you did. You captured it so beautifully. You have you always are able to capture the time, but in this case, it was just. I felt like I was back there in 1920. The book starts off just with it's such a great beginning. Of course, I'm not going to give anything away, but it does start off, of course, showing what the Babe was like, and of course the only death that ever took place in a major league baseball game, and so it's just exciting from the get go. And, of course, you had a wonderful character to work with, the Babe.
Yeah, you just can't match the Babe. He was a man-child in many ways. There was a boyishness to him that he never lost. It's clear he was a tremendous sense of fun, that he was, when he thought we were on this earth to enjoy ourselves. And he enjoyed himself. He never saw a meal he didn't want to eat or a woman he didn't want to get to know better or liquor that he didn't want to drink. So he lived life with both hands. And I think we also tend to forget what an incredible athlete he was. You know, he was one of the best pitchers in the majors for a number of years, and then he made himself the best hitter of all time. Now nobody does that. Nobody's ever done that.
No. So, it's,
you know, we see all these movies of him in middle age, and he's sort of fat and pigeon-toed and a little disillusioned. He's taken some tread off the tires. But, you know, when 1920, 21, he's in his mid-20s in age, and he was a horse. He was an amazing athlete.
And you bring it to life you bring him to life in all its glory and in general, the entire 1920s scene in New York, it's one of the best depictions of that era, and people will really feel like they are back there. And I assume there was quite a bit of research, because a lot of the things I didn't even know, and I read a lot of books about the 1920s, so I was really thrilled to discover so many things. You know, it was just wonderful.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to hear it. I do come out of writing history, so I'm used to doing the research. You can't ever let it overtake the story, but you know, you just find these amazing things that happened. I mean, it's a center of the beginning of the book. I'm happy to disclose it. In the middle of the 1920 season, Babe Ruth made a movie. it was a commercial release movie that was in theaters across the country. And, you know, on game days, he would film until sort of halfway through the day, and then he'd rush off to the park. And again, who does that? Who knew that happened? And you can even watch that movie on the internet.
I know. It's so fantastic. I didn't know that. And I was, being a great baseball fanatic, I was so thrilled to discover this.
Well, it's a pretty terrible movie.
Oh, yeah.
You do see the Babe.
Oh, yeah. But it's seeing the Babe and knowing that he did it. And just I don't know. There's so much joy in the way he approached things.
Yes, very much.
Very much. Now, of course, we'll talk about the protagonist of your book. This is, as I said, the third one. And they're really an unlikely duo. It's a sort of a strange duo. Dr. Jamie Fraser and Speed Cook. Tell us about them.
Yeah, they're driven by the story in the first book, which I won't get into. But one is Fraser is a white doctor. He's kind of middle class. He's kind of white bread. He's occasionally clueless. A bit of rectitude to him. Cook is modeled on a real life person, a man named Moses Fleetwood Walker, who was the last black man, pardon me, to play organized baseball or big league baseball between the 1880s and Jackie Robinson. I discovered that in the 1870s and 1880s, when professional baseball began, and it was kind of raggedy when it began, the teams were integrated. Black and white played together. The white players gradually drove all the black players out of the game. It was a racist era. And Fleet Walker was the last guy to get driven out, and he was angry about it the rest of his life. And he wrote a long pamphlet some years later, denouncing the Jim Crow laws, the lynchings, the way black people were so oppressed in this country. This is the early 20th century. Life was terrible for black folks. And I thought, boy, that's an interesting guy. And if you put him together with Jamie Fraser, you know, they're really from different planets. And how they figure out how to make common cause in things they both care about, and negotiate the distance between them. You know, I never wanted to sort of artificially have them become best pals. That seemed just not likely for the time.
Yeah, too artificial to do something.
Yeah, but they do develop a mutual respect. And frankly, today we are still negotiating the chasm between the races that our society has created. And this was a way for me to sort of look at ways people do that.
And you do it throughout the book. There's this understanding and talk about racism, and I think it's, you know, it's just sort of the in the back of the storyline, but it's there, and I think it makes people. I hope it makes people think about, you know, how stupid or how silly it is to be racist, I think that's that part of your book is very eye opening.
Well, and the Babe's a perfect vehicle for that, because he was, you know, hazed constantly in his playing career for being part black. A lot of black people actually thought he was part black, because many black people passed as white in that era. That was the way to escape the terrible discrimination. And the Babe himself seemed to have little race feeling. in the off season, he would play games against the Negro League teams and, you know, sort of pal around with them and joke around with them. He just liked to play baseball. It was a segregated society. It's not that, you know, he had a lot of close friends who were African American, but he didn't seem to have any anxiety about being around black people or any sense that they weren't people, which really was a dominant view at the time. So I think he gives you a great way to sort of carve into the issue.
Well, I think so too, and it's I think the relationship, of course, is growing between the two protagonists, and then how they you go throughout the story. You're talking, of course, on one hand about the sort of wholesomeness of baseball, of how we see it, and then there's all this back corruption, underlying corruption, that of course is the major subject of the book, the fixing of the games, you know.
The gamblers and the ballplayers hung out together. That was just what happened, and sometimes they could figure out ways to help each other.
Yeah, well, you know, it's and unfortunately, it's carried through, and that's one of the things that, you know, we saw with Pete Rose. So we know that it's been an ongoing problem.
I mean, professional tennis has been dealing with this in the last few years. There's considerable evidence that some players throw matches.
It's hard to imagine that people would do it. It's hard to understand how people would do it. But of course, money talks, and I guess that's sometimes it gets to people's heads. So,
well, we do have to remember, in 1920, ball players didn't make a lot of money.
No,
not like today. So, you know, if somebody offered you $5,000, that was a big deal. That might be your year's salary. It was a different time, and there were a number of players who got thrown out of the game for it.
Well, your book is, I think, it's just going to go down as one of the best baseball books in general because of the way you do weave all of these stories of the players and of baseball history. And many people don't understand or had no idea that baseball was really played originally by black teams, and that there were, you know, really major league black teams who were great players and really brought the whole game to the attention of Americans.
You know, the history of the Negro Leagues is something that's being unearthed day to day. There's a wonderful museum about the Negro Leagues out in Kansas City, Missouri, and it's part of our athletic history and our social history, frankly, that, you know, is really worth appreciating.
It is. And, you know, all they needed was a ball and a bat, and they could, you know, get out there and play. And they certainly did it with great exuberance.
Yeah.
And I was when I was researching what your book, then I discovered this lovely photo. And I had, again, baseball is so fascinating. It cuts across so many dimensions of our life. I had not ever seen before that Babe Ruth played with the in Los Angeles, I think. He played a game against the Japanese American Baseball League. And I had no idea the Japanese were involved in baseball in the 1920s, you know?
I think actually in the early 30s, he traveled to Japan and on a barnstorming tour, exhibition games, and played a few out.
So that's one of the exciting things about your book and just getting back there in history. And I think you've done a marvelous job with it. And I was just so thrilled that I got, one of my listeners had been talking about your book, and so I was reminded of it when I was looking out for something to do about baseball, and this just fell right into my mitt, let's put it that way.
I'm so glad it did.
And it's always wonderful when Well, I love books that really take, you know, blend fact and fiction. And part of it, I think part of it is I always like to check if the fact part is right. So I'm sort of like a book like yours turns me into a mini detective. So then I always double check if the writer got it right. And boy, oh boy, you are an amazing researcher. Of course, we're going to come have you back to talk about the Wilson Deception and the Lincoln Deception, which are both brilliant books.
Well, thank you.
You know,
I look forward to that.
And I know that you've done so much work about American presidents, and that's why I was going to have, you know, I wanted to have you on in January, February. I'm going to sort of concentrate on some president related books since it's going to be the inauguration and it's all, you know, everybody's going to be thinking about presidents. I thought, you know, you're the ideal guest because, well, between that and, of course, your book, Madison's Gift,
Five Partnerships that Made America.
Wow. That book is again, wonderful. And you know of what you write, you know, and that's I think that's always so much fun. My listeners, so many of them are trying to write or are in the midst of writing, and they're always interested in how you do research. Now, before I let you go, what's the best place? You mentioned the best place to do research for baseball books.
You know, for this book, I've read the biographies of the Babe that are available, and there are a number, and they're very good, and some accounts of, you know, what life was like for ballplayers in the 1920s and 19-teens. And I also find it's always helpful for me to read novels that were written at the time. I like to do that because it gives me a feeling for language, for words that people used and the way they put them together. You know, the way we use language changes over time. In the English language, you know, the way we speak, a lot of people from 1920 would find pretty weird. I don't want to mimic what they did, but I want to understand it and try to give a flavor of that. The other thing I was able to do, and very happy to be able to do, was listen to recordings of the Babe so I could hear how he spoke. And again, it's a way to hear the way words were. You know, one of the things that drives historical fiction writers crazy is, you know, you use a word and you think, oh my God, did they use that word back then? And happily, because this was the 1920s, most of the time, if I could remember my mother using it, it was okay. Because she had a very colorful vocabulary, and she used a lot of words. And so there were a lot of terms I could be comfortable with. But I do check them when I come up with a phrase. You hate to use an anachronistic term. So I have the Oxford English Dictionary, and I will look to see, you know, was that word in use for this meaning at the time. So that's another thing I think is important to do.
Well, David, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. As I said, today's a short interview. We're going to have you back in January, and we're going to have you on for the entire hour. And I just want to recommend to everyone that they get The Babe Ruth Deception. It's available, of course, wherever books are sold, on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. And you have a website.
Yes, davidostewart.com.
Okay, so people can go to your website. Again, thank you so much.
And
I'm heading off with our favorite song.
You bet.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
So long.
Okay. Well, since there's no baseball to go to this weekend, it's time to go to the Festival of Reading, which is on Saturday, November 12th. It's going to be at the University of South Florida in St. Pete. It's always a fantastic program, and they have so many wonderful authors there this year. And the admission is free, so that's perfect. The parking is free, and that's perfect. And many of the authors are authors that I have met and talked to, and one of them, there are four particular ones that I would, if you go there, please say hi for me. Say that you heard them on my show, Patsy with a Z on Joy on Paper. Ace Atkins is going to be there, Tim Dorsey, Brad Meltzer, and Amor Tolds. Now, their interviews are all available on my archive page, and it, you know, if you have a chance, go into my archive page and listen to their interviews before you head off to the Festival of Reading, which, of course, is presented by Tampa Bay Times every year, and it gets better and better, and they're bringing more and more authors. Oh, and I forgot, Jason Vork, the Yucks, 2 years in Tampa with the Louisianist team in NFL history is going to be there. So if you see Jason, just say hi to him from Patsy with a Z, because that is a fantastic book. And anybody who lives in the Tampa Bay area has to read that. It's not just full of the history of the Louisianist team, but just the general history of Tampa. And it's a fascinating book. And Amor Tolds, his book, A Gentleman in Moscow, is my number one book for the year because I just love that book. So I'm going to take a quick commercial break, and I'm coming back with Lee Bardugo. Okay?
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you an author? An artist? An inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z. And I am back with a very special guest, Lee Bardugo. I hope she's going to be on in a few minutes, right? And Ed is in the control room, is nodding his head. She's on the phone? Not yet. Okay, well, this is going to be serious here. if she doesn't show up today, this is going to be the third time.
They actually did call, and while you were giving an interview, and they're going to call back in about 3 minutes, which should be any minute.
Well, they just would not hold on. Okay. This is so funny. Okay. Well, her book is highly anticipated, and she is highly anticipated. So I am just waiting for her. So it just gives me a time again to say, if you go to the event this weekend, it's going to be fun. And if you, the reading festival, and if you go there, say Patsy with a Z sent you. And I'm looking forward to hearing if you get to do any selfies, if you do any selfies with any of the authors, particularly, they're all so wonderful. I can't even say which one I love the most, but Amor Tolds is, I think he's so brilliant. It's just amazing. So if you get a selfie with any of these authors, post them and put them on my Facebook page. Send them to me on my Facebook page and like me while you're there, because I like you and I love all of the authors that are going to be at the event. So I'm looking forward to hearing your comments. And if you have a favorite author that you pick up there and meet there, tell me and I'll invite them on the program. So now I'm looking at Big Ed in there, and he's on the phone, and he looks excited and happy, and I'm hoping that Lee, hi.
Hi.
Lee Bardugo. Okay, third time lucky. This is so funny. I think I felt mentally I've done this interview twice already, because the first time your people canceled. The second time, I don't know what happened. And now you're here. So I'm so happy.
Here.
Okay.
Yes, very happy to be here.
Well, I'm very happy you're here. And I'm just holding up the cover of your book, your new book, Crooked Kingdom, which, yeah, of course, everyone was saying was highly anticipated. Well, like you were anticipated today. And it is an amazing book. It's an amazing book in so many ways. Of course, the writing is beautiful. But I can tell you, your publisher loves you. Just loves you. No, publishers don't normally go this whole hog in, wow, this is a beautiful edition. It's amazing. I'd buy it, even if I didn't read it, just so I could hold it.
Well, I suspect that quite a few people have bought it and bought Six of Crows for exactly that reason.
I mean, it's embossed cover, and the inside, the paper they've used, it's amazing. It's just
very beautiful.
They don't do this for everybody, hon.
I'm a very special person.
You are very. That's it. I mean, they said, oh boy, we're doing something special for this girl because she is not just a brilliant writer. She's lots of fun.
Well, I think they really matched the look of the books to the content. You know, they went out of their way to make it all feel like it was almost part of the world, which I really love. Because I think when you're entering a fantasy world, it's nice to sort of hold a beautiful object in your hand. So I feel pretty lucky about that.
Well, you are very lucky because they really have. And of course, we're talking about, the new book, which was, of course, a follow-up, it's part of this duology of yours, of the absolute number one best-selling New York Times best-selling Six of Crows, which I think it was like just blew the minds of everyone who got it. So it's a marvelous book, and then it brings back the duology. The second book brings back this band of this band of people that you have put together, young people, and it's hard to imagine. They are very young, and I know the book is I hate when they always say like from this to this age, because then you feel like, oh,
don't really say that with Six of Crows. I think 12 and up or 14 and up. It might be 14 and up because the content is a little bit darker.
This is any adult will enjoy this book too. I mean, if they're into fantasy, you have created a major world, and I don't know even how you have done it, because it's amazing. Of course, it takes place in a city called Ketterdam, based on we know, of course, Amsterdam, and I think, do you pronounce it Ketterdam?
I just say Ketterdam.
You say Ketterdam.
I like a little sauce you put on that. That was nice.
Well, you know, when I was reading the book, I mean, it having, of course, been in Amsterdam, I don't like damn, so having been in Amsterdam, I was there with somebody from Texas, and they're like, Amsterdam, I'm in Amsterdam. Yeah, well, you have created... if you've ever been there in the fog, wow, you have really created the city.
Well, it's interesting because there is a lot of Amsterdam in there, and Ketterdam is the capital of a country called Kirch, which was heavily influenced by the Dutch Republic of the 1700s. And
The flavor.
Yeah, it's definitely a flavor, but there's also, I think people who read it will recognize a little bit of Victorian London in there, a little bit of Venice in there, and definitely some old New York, AKA New Amsterdam, as well. So there's quite a few influences on there, but I'm glad it took you someplace different, took you out of your reality a little bit.
Oh, it takes you out of reality. You're in another.
I hope it did, unless you're on an impossible heist with a crew of thugs and thieves. Well, it's an exciting reality.
It does. And of course, it is based on the characters of that you, well, and that's a character, it's based on sort of Grisha. The Grisha world that you created, which is, what can we say about the Grisha world?
I wrote the Grisha trilogy, which was which takes place before Six of Crows, but you don't have to read it to read Six of Crows or Crooked Kingdom. You do have to read Six of Crows if you want to read Crooked Kingdom, or you're going to be real lost. But the trilogy and the duology really exist in separate countries with different casts of characters. And the Grisha trilogy is really, you know, it's set in a world where magic almost operates a little bit more like science, and it's become militarized. So there's a country called Ravka that has recruited Grisha, these magic wielders from all over the world, to essentially serve as a kind of special ops team in their country. And there's, you know, all over the world, Grisha are sometimes very valued for their gifts. They're sometimes sold for their gifts, and they're sometimes hated for their gifts. So there's very different attitudes towards them at different places in this world.
Well, you must have, you have an absolutely marvelous mind. I mean, it's
it's thank you. I'll try to remember that the next time I don't know where my keys are.
It's convoluted. It's, oh, wow. It's like a kaleidoscope going on in there. tell us a little bit about the main characters, because it was described in one of the blurbs like misfits. But it's more than that. They are misfits, I suppose, of society. But they're not the good guys, and they're not the bad guys. They're sort of,
yeah. I mean, Six and Crows is you know, it's a heist book, and you know, a big part of the heist is the team. And I would say this is definitely darker than something like Ocean's 11, but I think people will recognize the form and the twists and the turns and, you know, the whole assembling the team and trying to break into a place that's never been breached before.
And, of course, the leader, Kaz.
Yeah, the leader is a guy named Kaz Brekker. He's a kind of young criminal prodigy who has worked his way up through the gangs of this city, Ketterdam. Ketterdam is this kind of trading hub, right? So it's all the legal trade of the world passes through it, but all the illegal trade, too. And so there's a kind of thriving criminal underworld. And Kaz is working his way up in this gang, and he's the one who is offered this chance to try to pull off this heist and pulls together a crew. And some of these kids know each other, and they are young. They're, you know, 17, 18. But I think that means something different in a fantasy world than it means in our world. You know, there's no real adolescence. There's no real, like, sort of sheltered teenage years in the world that I've created. And, yeah, he pulls together Inej, who is a kind of spy who rules the roofs of Ketterdam. She's known as the Wraith, pretty good with her knives. There's a guy named Jesper, who's a gunslinger, who has quite a problem with gambling and risk. There's a woman named Nina, who is a Grisha. She's a magic wielder, and considered a witch by a guy named Matthias, who's best described as a witch hunter. And they have a past because they have quite a few prejudices about each other. And then there's Wyland, who's kind of the baby of the gang. He's somebody who really, he's a runaway. He's from a very wealthy family, and he really doesn't, really does not belong with this crew, at least to start out.
Yeah, he was like, who did he remind me of? This sort of the Sal Mineo in some movie. Oh, I can't my mind with. Yeah, exactly. You know, the group works together to pull off a con job in the new book in Crooked Kingdom, and it's quite a complicated process. And you really are fantastic at sort of weaving in all sorts of layers of and depth to the con job.
Thank you. Well, I mean, Six of Crows is sort of one big heist, and Crooked Kingdom is a little different. It's sort of con upon scheme upon con, and I wanted to kind of create a feeling of claustrophobia in the reader, where this crew is now sort of trapped in their own city, and they're seeing their resources and their allies get cut off one by one. So when something goes wrong, they have a lot, they have fewer resources to draw on than they did before. And I wanted to kind of escalate that through the book until the final battle scene, or the final con scene. I will say that it is a tremendous challenge to write. Because you're really building these layers upon layers and these little twists and reveals of information. I think one of the things we love about a heist or a con is the moment where we see something come together that we didn't even realize was coming together. So those are the moments I always write to.
Well, it's very suspenseful. You really are doing a great job in, you know, putting all these different layers and by going back and forth between different points of view. You know, many writers are unsure how to tackle point of view, but you've tackled it in a major way. You know, you.
Well, I don't think Six of Crows or Crooked Kingdom could have been my first book. You know, I wrote three books before this, and I just don't think I had the chops. I didn't. My craft wasn't where it needed to be, and I don't think I had the confidence to pull off a story this complicated with, you know, multiple POV and heists and flashbacks and prison breaks and all of that. It's just I was sort of learning on the job, so I'm glad it worked for you.
Well, you learned. you did a good job here. You got the PhD in juggling point of view, I think. if they're, you know, if they want to do in a university, they want to do a PhD in writing, they can have a special one for a juggling point of view, because it is not easy. And anyone who has ever tried it, many people have failed and given up and gone back to the first person and just say, okay, I'm just writing everything first person because I can't handle it. But,
well, you know, I think first person presents its own challenges too. But when I realized I wanted to write a heist book, I knew I could not. I mean, I'm sure it can be done in first person, but I knew I couldn't do it in first person. And I wanted to have the kind of agility that that multiple points of view would give me.
And you managed that, and you really made their voices distinct. And I think that was part of the brilliance of the book.
Thank you. That process really happens in revision. I get a lot of questions from aspiring writers who are you know, in the first draft process, and they say things like, how do I get my voices to sound distinct, and how do I get my characters to feel real? And you know, my reply is always that in the first draft, they're not going to feel real, and they're not going to feel fully fleshed out. I mean, I'm sure there are writers who have drafts like that. Actually, I'm not sure that there are writers who have drafts like that. I really don't think there's any way to outsmart the first draft. Your first draft is not going to be good. It's going to be really bad. And for me, a lot of the characters don't settle in that first draft.
Well, as Tolstoy's wife can tell you, she does the first one and writes out everything, and then he comes back and he says, well, that was only a draft, my dear. We're now going to have you handwrite another yeah. War and Peace. You know?
Luckily, we now have laptops, so Tolstoy's wife had a much easier time of it.
Oh, but, yes. Can you imagine? Yeah. I think he went through, what, seven drafts or something like that. Sometimes I really feel sorry for the woman. She's writing all the. Oh.
I think about that a lot when I see, you know, when I think about people writing these books longhand and how different that process is. And it's possible that drafting, that if I were writing longhand, I would be writing a more thoughtful first draft. But for me, the first draft is really where I tell myself the story and I get to know the characters. It's kind of like a prolonged first awkward, very awkward first date with all of them. So
yeah, can you imagine Marcel Proust writing drafts of Remembrance of Things Past, you know, 3,200 pages?
Longhand.
One longhand in the first place. And then having to
Madeline next to him. Yeah,
yeah, and then having to redo it. Oh my gosh! So we are lucky. What? Just a technical question, because writers are always asking me this. What program do you use to write in?
I use Scrivener and I use Microsoft Word.
Okay, good. I love Scrivener, and I've told so many writers that it. You know, when you're doing something as complicated as this, where you have so many characters and so many things to maintain, I just find Scrivener so much easier, you know, to just keep it in order.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I wrote my first three books in Word, but they were all first-person POV and fairly linear. I don't think I could have written, or I think they'd be very different books if I hadn't been able to write Six of Crows and Crooked Kingdom and Scrivener. Because, I mean, the thing about Scrivener is it's quite intimidating initially. It's always intimidating, and I think it always feels very scary to throw a wrench into your writing process, because we all feel it's so delicate and this thing that needs to be preserved. But, you know, I use probably a tiny percentage of the features that Scrivener has, but it allows me to color code POV, it allows me to see the whole outline, and it allows me to move chapters and to move in between chapters with a speed that I just didn't have before. And I think, yes, when you're trying to build a plot with any amount of complexity, I think it saves me a lot of time and frustration to be able to move between chapters that way. And I write on very tight deadlines now, so I think any bit of time you can save that then can, and energy that then goes back into the actual writing, is something to be grateful for.
Well, of course, you are in such demand, and I think, you know, you have very avid fans. Your fans love you. They were waiting for this book to come out. I know that I think you might very well have had, like, the pre-order record, you know, other than J.K. Rowling's, when, you know, that people were signing up for
overestimating, but thank
you. You know, the minute they finished, you know, your last book, they're signing up for the new one. And I know that many of them have complained that this was a duology and not a trilogy.
Yeah, but that's what the shape of the story was.
That was the story. So you had it, and that world is there. And of course, the people are very lucky. They have, if they have your book, they can reread it and go back into this world, because they are. I like books where, besides the fact that it's such a beautiful book just to keep and to hold, it is a book that I'm sure readers go through more than once. Because each time you see something that you sort of missed in the first reading.
I hope so. I mean, you, as a writer, you know this. You pour so much of your time and your heart into each book. And, you know, I'll get messages from readers saying, oh, I read the book in 4 hours. I'm like, oh, God, that was a year of my life. But it's really gratifying when somebody goes back to the book. And when it becomes, you know, when I was younger, I don't really reread a lot now, but when I was younger, I had certain books that I reread almost compulsively and that were really, no matter how dire they were or intense they were, became comfort reads. And being that for another reader means a lot to me, especially as a fantasy writer and reader myself. So,
well, you know, as I said, you've develop these characters that young people, particularly, although I, as I said, any age can read these books, but young people, I think, sort of, they look for something that really touches their lives. And I think having them, the characters being young, they can see, they can make these connections to their own lives, and there are parallels in your books to reality, you know. So
yeah.
I think very much so.
Well, you know, it's interesting. A huge, and I imagine there are some of your listeners are wary of young adult books because they're not young adults. But I think it's important to remember that a huge portion of the people who read young adults are, in fact, adults. And it's not that they are so invested in teenage stories. It's that these stories happen or usually take place at a point of upheaval in people's lives. And so I don't think it's surprising that people who, you know, it's not as if you hit age 18 and all of a sudden you're an adult, right? Like, okay, I'm done maturing. I've got all my wisdom. You're a very different person at 28 or 38, 48 or 58 than you were at 18, or that you were at 28 or 38 or 48. And, you know, there are these big moments in your life where you move, you know, and all of a sudden you have to find a new tribe of friends, right? Or you get married, or you get divorced, or you get married again. You know, there's a lot of different first kisses in your life, and there's a lot of moments of tremendous transition. You know, you have kids, or, you know, and then you have to meet a whole new group of people. And there are these moments that really hark back to what we think of as teenage experiences, these kind of coming-of-age experiences, and these moments of tremendous upheaval and change where you're trying to figure out who you are and where you belong. So I don't think it's surprising that a lot of adults find these themes resonant. And I would hope that, you know, if people are wary of stepping into that aisle, a lot of these books, I think they're going to find tremendous resonance with.
Well, I agree. And because you do address so many different things, from change of faith to mental illness to physical disabilities, you know, it's all in there, weaved within the storylines. And makes it very relatable for every human being, because these are all things that we've all had to deal with, you know, with our lives or with other people's lives. So that's, I think, part of the genius of your work.
Thank you.
And you know, let's talk a little bit about it's hard, of course, always to when you have so many wonderful characters, but let's talk a little bit about Kaz, because one of the things is, he does have a physical disability, and so often the lead character doesn't have any, you know, problems. So
Yeah, Kaz had his leg broken when he was young, and it didn't heal right, and he walks with a limp, and is in. And is in pain most of the time, and that is the way that he deals with that is definitely a part of the story, both in Six of Crows and Crooked Kingdom. I have a disability myself. I have a condition called vascular necrosis or osteonecrosis, which means that I sometimes have to walk with a cane, and that I do have to deal with chronic pain. And weirdly enough, when I was writing Kaz, I didn't really think about the fact, this was sort of the year when I was accepting the fact that I was going to start to have a visible disability and I was going to be out there walking with a cane. I didn't think about that in the first draft, and it was only when I went back to it that I thought, oh, of course, this is why I'm writing this character. But I think it's... I think, you know, I didn't go out of my way. There's a lot of talk about diversity, and you can say, you know, that that things don't feel organic, or they don't feel this, or they don't feel that, or you're just putting things in for the sake of being diverse. And I really think that's a lot of nonsense. You know, my world has never looked particularly homogenous, and so it didn't make sense to me to create a crew of people who are all the same, who all have the same religious background, or who are all from the same race, or who are all have, you know, shaped the same way, or who are all had the same kind of emotional or mental abilities. And
well, you know, and this is what happens with writers. Sometimes the characters just, they're just born in your mind. They come out, and that's the way they are. And you're... You know, as a writer, you just go with the flow because they're almost you know, an extension of something in within you. You know, you know these characters.
You know, I wish that my characters arrived more fully formed, and I'm all for going with the flow if the flow is there. But for me, there are very, you know, Matthias is this character who is a witch hunter, and
oh, yeah,
he arrived almost fully formed. You know, he had this very loud voice because he's so dogmatic, but most of my characters are not that easy for me to get a handle on when I'm first writing them, and they really have to be refined into what they become on the page.
Well, now, when you, as you said, now you're on a timeline, once you're, you know, beloved by publishers, what are you working on now?
Quite a few things. I was tapped to write the Wonder Woman young adult novel by Random House in D.C.
Ooh!
Yeah, I'm really excited about that. So I'm finishing up copy edits on that, and that will be coming out in August of 2017. It's called Wonder Woman Warbringer, and we're going to be revealing the cover tomorrow. And then,
wow, and so at that, Wonder Woman in that book is going to be a teenager?
Yeah, it's going to be Diana at age 17, before she became the hero we know now, and I have to say it was really a joy to write her. She's really, she's very different from, I tend to write about characters who are very morally gray, and Diana is not. She is,
she's Wonder Woman.
She's an actual hero. She's Wonder Woman. She's a character of tremendous strength, but she also has tremendous compassion, and I thought that might be boring to write, and I was really wrong. Like, she's an absolute... I feel very good when I finished writing a Wonder Woman chapter. And then I also just announced I'm going to actually be writing two books, I guess, in the adult world. Not, you know, adult, like sexy adult, like just for adults. Those books are called Ninth House, and they're set at Yale. And
What is the name of them?
Ninth House is going to be the series.
Uh-huh.
And it's set at Yale, where I went to college, and the secret society is there. So it's a fantasy that is set on a college campus. I'm really excited about it. So I have quite a few things brewing, and a few other things we're going to be announcing soon as well.
Well, and I'm sure one of them will be a movie deal.
I hope so.
I'm sure so, because... Six of Crows and Crooked Kingdom are, well, let me say, they were made for the film. You know, they read like fantasy films. As I said, because I was drawn into the world, and I was so drawn into the world that sometimes as I was reading it, and I tend to read like early in the morning, like 4 or 5 in the morning, I get up, I have depending
on. I do not even know what 4 a.m. looks like, but okay.
Well, I love to get up before everybody else is around and before there's lots of noise and, you know, a cup of tea or a cup of coffee, and I'm sitting with this book, and I'm just, oh, and I suddenly realize I am in a different world, and it's a fantastic feeling, and I'm sure that you're going to have lots of fun.
That's a really lovely compliment.
Well, because you are a really great writer, and you certainly deserve all this attention that you've gotten with your books. And as I said, when you're beloved of a publisher, you are really a lucky person. Well, I'm so glad we finally got you on. Third time was lucky.
I'm glad we finally got a chance to chat.
Okay, well, Lee, thank you so much. And do you have a website that people can look at?
Yeah, if you just go to my name, L-E-I-G-H, Lee Bardugo, B as in boy, A-R-D-U-G-O, LeeBardugo.com. You can find all my information there and where I'll be touring. And I'll be in Y'all Fest in South Carolina this weekend and Miami Book Fair the next weekend. And yeah, come and find me.
Okay, because, well, I'm sure so many of your fans will just be so thrilled to be with you, and to they love to get selfies with their favorite authors, and I know
it's quite a change from the solitary writing life, I have to say.
It's a wonderful thing, and so I want to really thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you for all the kind words about the book.
And when the Wonder Woman book comes out, you have to come back on, okay?
I would love to.
Okay. Thanks so much, Lee. Nice talking to you. Okay, wow, that's nice. Okay, Lee is really nice. She's sweet and as I said, very, very talented. And you don't get the kind of deals that she gets unless you're talented. And I was really thrilled that we finally got through. So anyway, lots of exciting things coming up. Next week, I'm going to have David Baldacci on. And that's exciting. And I've got a lot of other things coming up, and I just want to have, let me think. Oh, there's so many things to think about at this point. But anyway, I will, I just wanted to say also I have Larry Block coming on to talk about his book. So I've got a lot of things happening. Meanwhile, just have a great weekend. No more politics this weekend, hopefully. And we can just all get back to reading good books and spending our time on the beach or in the hammock and just enjoying a really great book. And try the Babe Ruth Deception or Lee's book. They're really great. Meanwhile, just find your joy and share it and treasure it and have a great weekend. Bye now.